From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Richard E. Grant. He stars with Melissa McCarthy in Can You Ever Forgive Me? And is nominated for several awards. Grant made his film debut in With Nail and I. He grew up in Africa, in Swaziland, where his father was director of education. His father was also an alcoholic who once put a gun to Grant's temple.
I said, you know, go ahead, shoot me, get it over with. And because he was so drunk, when he pulled the trigger, he missed.
And we'll hear some great new roots and rockabilly Christmas songs performed in our studio by their composer, J.D. McPherson, and his band.
Shoppers are hopping and humming a tune. Happy holidays and how do you do? What's that sound? It sounds like Christmas time.
And Maureen Carrigan will tell us her picks for the best books of the year. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Richard E. Grant, gives a terrific performance opposite Melissa McCarthy in the film Can You Ever Forgive Me? That performance has already earned a Best Supporting Actor Award from the New York Film Critics Circle. He's also nominated for a Golden Globe, an Independent Spirit Award, and an award from SAG, the Screen Actors Guild. Grant made his film debut in 1987 in the movie With Nail and I, playing an out-of-work actor, which he was at the time he got the part. He grew up in Africa, in Swaziland, which was a British protectorate when he was a child. His father was Swaziland's director of education, but he was also an alcoholic who could become abusive. Before we hear the interview, let's hear a scene from Can You Ever Forgive Me? The movie is based on Lee Israel's memoir of the same name. Melissa McCarthy plays Israel, a writer who's broke and spends a lot of her days in a neighborhood bar in Manhattan drinking alone. Later in the film, she starts making decent money by selling her forged letters from writers she loves, like Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward. In this scene, she's sitting at the bar when a man walks in, played by Richard E. Grant. He calls out her name and says he remembers meeting her before, but she doesn't remember that. He sits down, uninvited, at the bar stool next to her.
Last time I saw you, thank you, we were both pleasantly pissed at some horrible book party. Am I right?
It's slowly flooding back to me. You're friends with, Julie or something.
Steinberg?
Yeah.
She's not an agent anymore. She died.
She did? Jesus, that's young.
Maybe she didn't die. Maybe she just moved back to the suburbs. I was confused those two. No, that's right. She got married and had twins.
Better to have died.
Indeed. I've just come from having my teeth bleached. How do they look?
Why would you do that?
Oh, teeth are a dead giveaway.
Okay.
Can I buy you a drink? Even though you're the posh writer.
Thank you.
Craigie, top her up.
Richard E. Grant, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your performance in that film and on the awards you've gotten for it and the awards you're nominated for. I'm delighted
Thank you very much, Terry.
Been honored this way. the script for this, your performance is so great and the script is so good. Even your line in it that you bleached your teeth because teeth are a dead giveaway. Like, we have no idea yet what they might be giving away, what they might be betraying about you.
Right.
Yeah. So you and Melissa McCarthy both play, you know, alcoholics, but you deal with your depression and your issues differently. She's kind of like withdrawn from the world, whereas you've become like very extroverted and theatrical in the world. Did you talk with her about the differences in your characters and how they handle their own depression and despair?
I met Melissa McCarthy, I think, in the middle of January last year in Manhattan for a couple of hours on a Friday morning, and then we had a meal together. And I knew instantly, and she, mostly for me, felt the same. An instant empathy or way of looking at the script and these characters. I've said this before, watching her work, it was like the center of her gravity shifted and the natural buoyancy and ebullience of her character was completely subsumed and submerged into playing Lee Israel without any ounce, as far as I was aware, of sentimentality, vanity, any of the things that you could easily fall into when you're playing a character who is so misanthropic and prickly as Lee Israel obviously was. So once I knew that that is precisely where she was going, and of course that was the dream, that she did exactly what the Lee Israel memoir, Can You Ever Forgive Me, implies, with this incredible caustic wit, I knew that by contrast, playing a man, Jack Hock, who was HIV positive, that as an audience you only find that out in the final scene that he has in the story, but knowing that right from the beginning meant that everything that I did and all the choices I made were based upon a man who was completely hedonistic, driven by pleasure and enjoying life in the moment, for the moment.
Nothing to lose.
At the moment. Nothing to lose because, you know, if you quote Scarlett O'Hara, there is no, the possibility that there is no tomorrow for his character.
So you're playing a character who isn't an actor, but who treats life as a form of theater. Were you ever that way? Have you known people that way?
No, but I was at drama school with somebody who still owes me money, who was larger than life, a complete scallywag, louche, dissolute. But you knew that even if you lent him money, as long as you didn't lend him the keys to your apartment or your car or anything, there was something so attractive and life-enhancing about this kind of person that it's like taking a gamble, knowing that you're never going to get your money back. But no, I'm not like that at all.
So somebody who is like that, who is similar to Jack Hock in some ways, though probably not quite as dangerous, did you feel you could get only so close without being burned? Like he was a life force in some ways, but really like a negative force in others?
Yes, because his foot is firmly on the pedal of the self-destruct. And as he reveals partway through the story, he doesn't have any friends to share a secret with because they've all died of AIDS.
Yeah. So your character, as is Melissa McCarthy's character, is an alcoholic. Your father was an alcoholic. Did you base anything of your character and how your character handled alcohol on your father?
I'm allergic to alcohol, ironically, but my father was somebody who was very charming by day and then literally Jekyll and Hyde, very violent by night when he was drunk. And Jack Hock has no violence at all in him. If anything, he is somebody that gets beaten up by people, as happens in the story. So what is autobiographical is that my observation as a kid and as a teenager was that the concentration that alcoholics have or drunks have when they're trying to cross a room and not fall over or bump into things or convince the world that they are sober, that concentration and focus is what I latched onto.
And describe how that works in your character, like, because he always seems kind of in control of his language. Like, he's a terrific speaker. He's a very, like, funny, caustic speaker. And he knows how to manipulate people really well. So in a lot of ways, he seems in control, you know, like very much in control.
Yeah. But his life is completely out of control because there's no apartment. He's destitute,
right.
Literally hustling right. on the street. I also have experience of people who, and I expect you have too, that somebody can be really drunk but manage to sound completely articulate, even if they're slightly slurring at the edges, but they're very articulate in their drunkenness. And I think that that's one of the kind of the fallacies of being drunk, that, you know, they say that when people are drunk, they tell you the truth. Well, what they tell you isn't, in my experience, is not the truth, but a very warped, toxic version of the truth. And it can very often come out with great articulacy, but it doesn't mean that that is truth or kind.
Mm-hmm. If you made an autobiographical film called Wawa, mm-hmm. There's a couple of really disturbing scenes in the film. Your character, the person who, you know, you're portrayed as, is a child. I think the character ranges from about 10 to a teenager. And when he's around 10, he wakes up in the back seat of the car to find that his mother and his father's friend are having sex in the front seat. This actually happened to you. How old were you, and were you old enough to even know what sex was?
I was 10 years old, and I knew that what I was seeing, I shouldn't be seeing. And I tried God, got no answer. I couldn't tell my friends. I certainly couldn't tell my father or my mother what I'd seen, because I was supposed to be asleep on the back seat. So I lived with this kind of, felt like a toxic secret for decades. And it was the thing that was the catalyst for starting to keep a diary, because I thought the only way that I can keep a record of this and feel sane was to write it down. And so I've been a lifelong diarist ever since.
Weren't you afraid your mother or father would go through your room and find the diary?
I suppose I was, and I hid it, but the breakup of their marriage was so acrimonious that I don't think looking for a diary of a 10-year-old was something that was even on their radar whatsoever.
I'm also thinking just how, like, really, I hate to be judgmental, but how, like, just kind of stupid and wrong it is to have sex in the front seat with your 10-year-old in the back seat. I mean, it's not like you were unconscious. You were just, like, napping. It was likely you were going to wake up.
Well, it was 10 o'clock at night, and we'd been out at a cricket match all day, so I suppose they thought, well, you know, grab the opportunity when they can, and lust blinds people to doing things that, in retrospect, they, you know, would feel sorry for. And when I finally had a face-to-face with my mother about this 20 years ago, she broke down in front of me and said three magic words. She said, "Please forgive me." Mm-hmm. And the power of that was astonishing and remains so, and led to the complete rapprochement that I have with her. So I now speak to her on Skype once a week.
So did your father start drinking more after that?
People tell me, and from my childhood recollection, I don't remember him drinking in any to excess at all before he got divorced. But I know that the day that my mother left, and she said to me very early in the morning when she left at, I don't know, 5:30, 6 a.m., she said, "You won't have to go to school today." My father was paralytically drunk that night, and then basically drank for the remaining years of his life. Mm. And I found out on his deathbed, when he could barely speak because he had brain and lung cancer, he said, "I never stopped loving your mother." And I thought he was referring to my stepmother, of course, and I said, "Do you mean my stepmother who just walked out of the ward?" And he said, "No, your mother." So I knew then, it was literally, it felt like a bomb going off in my face, because I understood in that moment the tragedy of his life, that he had never stopped loving her. But as a child, for those 15 years post their divorce, it seemed that they were so acrimonious towards each other that the idea that he could have loved her or still loved her was inconceivable to me. But of course now, you know, as an adult, I understand that.
Right. Another, like, really horrifying sequence in your autobiographical movie, Wawa, is, like, you went to boarding school, you started acting there, and you came home on a break, and your father saw you in makeup that you were wearing for a play. He called you a fairy. And then he took out his gun and chased after you and shot at you. Would you describe what happened?
I had been to see A Clockwork Orange, which had a ban. You know, I was 14 years old, and you had to be 21 years old at that time to go and see that X-rated movie. It was triple X-rated where I grew up. So I snuck out to see that with my best friend, and had one of those Malcolm McDowell eyelashes that I'd stuck down on my face, and he was outraged that I had, A, had gone to see this film, and that, B, had come back wearing this thing. I then, because he was drunk and trying to stop him drinking, I emptied a crate of Scotch whiskey down the sink and didn't realize that he was still awake, and he came at me with a revolver, chased me around the garden or the yard, as you call it, and found me, cornered me, and you know, gun to my temple, and said, "I'm going to blow your brains out." And I said, at that point, I was so, I'd had such a guts full of living this sort of charmed life by day and then this alcoholism by night, that I said, "You know, go ahead, as I do in the movie, shoot me, get it over with." And because he was so drunk, when he pulled the trigger, he missed. So, which is how I'm here today.
You think he was actually trying to aim and shoot you?
Oh, I don't think, I know. Yeah, somebody's got, I don't know whether you've had that experience, if somebody's got the barrel of the gun literally pressed against your forehead, there's nowhere else to go. You know that is their intent. And when they're violent and drunk and abusive, then there is no escape. It felt like there was no escape. I thought that was the end of my life.
You've mentioned that in another interview, that when your father died, there was an evangelical minister presiding over the funeral.
Yes.
And describe what happened at the end.
Well, there was a young man called Becky Gumedze, who was Swazi, who'd done an evangelical course in the USA and had come back to Swaziland. And his father had been, ironically, the man who became the Swazi Minister of Education after independence. So they were great family friends. And he misguidedly believed that he could raise people from the dead. And so he jumped into the grave, because my father refused to have a church service when he could still, you know, when we talked about his funeral arrangements. He jumped into the grave, undid the casket and opened it up and tried to, you know, he said, "I'm going to raise him, Mahlaginipani," which is this Swazi name he was given. "I'm going to raise Mahlaginipani from the dead. I'm going to raise him from the dead." And then, of course, you know, my father was a cadaver of, you know, 65 pounds. And there's this awful Monty Python-like Joe Orton grotesque moment when, you know, everybody leant forward, myself included, to look in almost the mistaken desire or belief that maybe a miracle was going to happen. Then Becky had to be consoled because he then collapsed on top of my father's corpse and in an hysterical state because he felt that his faith had failed him. So he had to be hauled out. And we actually filmed this with a young Swazi actor who'd been training in England. And when we tested it with test audiences, they said that almost to a man and woman, in all the written response, was that it was too out there and too bizarre at this point in the story to take. So I very reluctantly cut it out. But in the making of documentary, there is footage of that.
Well, why did you want to act? What made you want to start acting? And I'm wondering, when I'm asking this, if it was a good way to kind of get out of your life. Because with your parents having the acrimonious relationship that they did, and your father having tried to shoot you, and like just crazy things going on, I could see how it would be a relief to be somebody else for a while.
Yes, and I escaped from, I mean, it's a perfectly valid point that you made. I started making theatres out of shoeboxes with painted scenery, a desk-side lamp, a little hole in the top for lighting, and cut out figures from magazines stuck on lollipop sticks going, you know, either side of the shoebox, and then progressed to glove puppets and string puppets, marionettes, and a full-size theatre in my parents' garage, amateur plays, school plays, and the amateur theatre club, which existed in Swaziland. So it was a very clear progression. What wasn't clear is that anybody from there could possibly make a living and pursue this as a career seriously. That was what was deemed ludicrous.
In the TV series, the HBO series Girls that Lena Dunham created, you played somebody who Jessa meets in rehab. You're both in rehab, and Jessa is the British friend of Hannah, of Hannah, which is Lena Dunham's character. So again, you're playing somebody with like addiction problems in that. And Jessa, I don't know, Jessa to me was always like the least likable of all of the characters. I mean, she was like a liar and very manipulative. And you knew that she had problems underneath, but she'd always be covering them up. But I just want to play a scene that you're both in. So this takes place in rehab. And you're both sitting in your room in rehab talking and smoking.
Are you allowed to smoke in here?
I am.
How do you get them to leave you alone?
I have a very respectable accent.
Yeah, well, so do I.
But you have the accent of a little girl who grew up somewhere between Heathrow and JFK. My daughter's is similar.
How old is she?
About your age, I guess. I haven't seen her for a while. Her mother hates me and she takes after her mother.
Do you know that today in group, some dumb bitch threw coffee in my face, all because I told her that she's a lesbian? I did her that favour. I just got to it quickly rather than this bullshit of everyone tiptoeing around it and just told her she's a raging dyke.
Dyke or no dyke, people have to come to things in their own time. Now, you have to learn when honesty is righteous and when honesty is nothing more than a party trick.
You're a real for not knowing how old your daughter is.
All right. Filtered through the kaleidoscope of your own daddy issues.
I do not have daddy issues.
Please. We all have them. Now, periodically, if you can, take time to reflect on the daddy issues that your daddy had with his daddy and his daddy with his daddy and his daddy before him and every daddy that's been going on daddying before that daddy. I know you know this. You're quite wise.
You know nothing about me.
Wisdom comes from experience. And I suspect you've had many, many experiences. Too many, probably, for someone of your age.
I've had fun.
But it wasn't always fun, was it?
No.
That's a scene from Girls with my guest Richard E. Grant and Jemima Kirk. When you got the part, did Lena Dunham or anyone else know about your background and that your father was an alcoholic and that you certainly had father issues?
No, not as far as I know. Lena cast me because she'd seen me in Spice World, the movie. I know. Go figure that one.
I guess you never know who's watching and what it's going to lead to.
Exactly. Yeah, Adele gave me tickets to go and see her show. We share the same birthday and not the same bank balance, to go and see her show in London because she was a Spice World fan. And yet when I did the movie in 1996, I was berated by people for doing something that they said was not highbrow enough. You know, what are you doing a Spice Girls movie for? And I said, for my eight-year-old daughter.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, it worked. I mean, it had a happy ending, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Richard E. Grant, it's just been really great to talk with you. Congratulations on Can You Ever Forgive Me and your awards and nominations. And thank you so much for talking with us. It's been great to talk with you.
Thank you, Dr. Freud.
Richard E. Grant is nominated for several awards, including a Golden Globe, an Independent Spirit Award, and a SAG Award for his performance in Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's the time of the year again when we ask our book critic Maureen Corrigan for her list of the year's best books. So here's Maureen with her top 10 list.
Many of the best of this year's books were graced with humor and distinguished by deep dives into American identity. Oddly, it was also a very good year for deceased authors, whose posthumously published books were so much more than mere postscripts to their careers. Rebecca Mackay's novel, The Great Believers, is my pick for novel of the year. It's a sweeping story about the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s and its long, numb aftermath. As one of the main characters says about the random cruelty of AIDS, "This disease has magnified all our mistakes. Some stupid thing you did when you were 19, the one time you weren't careful, and it turns out that was the most important day of your life." The Great Believers is filled with vivid characters, absorbing questions about art, belief, and transcendence, and most improbably, lots of wit. Speaking of wit, Gary Steingart's Lake Success dusts off our most hallowed literary trope, the on-the-road novel, and takes it for a satirical spin through an America on the verge of a Trump presidency. His anti-hero is Barry Cohen, a New York finance guy whose life has imploded, prompting Barry to board a Greyhound bus and light out for the territory. The end of the road finds Barry in California, which is where Tommy Orange's inspired debut novel, There, There, is set. Oakland, California, to be precise, the place about which Gertrude Stein once said, "There is no there there." Orange's story, which focuses on a group of urban Native Americans, begins with an unforgettable 10-page prologue that riffs on some 500 years of Native people's history, presented mostly through the image of Indian heads. Two other novels on my Best of the Year list are set long ago and far away. Warlight by Michael Ondaatje is a memory tale about two children abandoned to the care of a stranger in the London of 1945. Need I even say, at this point in Ondaatje's celebrated career, that the writing here is gorgeous? Listen to this description of post-war London. There were parts of the city where you saw no one, only a few children, walking solitary, listless as small ghosts. The city still felt wounded, uncertain of itself. It allowed one to be ruleless. Everything had already happened, hadn't it? Washington Black by Essie Edwigen is also a historical novel narrated by a child, but there the comparisons end. Opening on a sugar plantation in Barbados in 1830, the story is told by an enslaved 11-year-old boy known as Wash. Wash escapes from that plantation via hot air balloon, no less, and Edwigen herself breaks away from the confines of the conventional, transporting readers into the giddy realms of Romantic-era travelogue and scientific exploration. A nonfiction book about slavery opened up more of that harrowing history for readers this year. Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon was crafted out of interviews she did in Alabama in 1927 with Cudjoe Lewis. Lewis, then 86, was the last known living person who could recount firsthand the experience of having been captured in Africa and taken on a slave ship to the United States. Hurston's manuscript was completed in 1931, but publishers back then weren't interested. Barracoon is a monumental little book that dramatizes two extraordinary voices in conversation. Another posthumous book on my list is Dennis Johnson's short story collection, The Largesse of the Sea Maiden. When Johnson wrote at reckless full force, as he does in many of these stories about divorce, dying, and Elvis impersonators, his words blasted barriers, discovering those odd places where, as one of his narrators here says, the mystery winks at you. One mystery in particular obsessed the late Michelle McNamara, the cold case of a serial predator she dubbed the Golden State Killer. McNamara was midway into writing an account of this monster's crimes when she died in her sleep at age 46. Colleagues drew on her research to complete the book called I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It's not only a great true crime narrative, but also a nuanced investigation into McNamara's own preoccupation with the Golden State Killer. By the way, a suspect was arrested this spring, a couple of months after McNamara's book came out. The only violence in Michelle Dean's nonfiction book Sharp is the verbal kind. Sharp is an entertaining and erudite cultural history of 10 women who became critics and public intellectuals, even though, as Dean says, they came up in a world that was not eager to hear women's opinions about anything. Dean's subjects include the aforementioned Zora Neale Hurston, Mary McCarthy, Pauline Kael, and the immortal Dorothy Parker. Sharp is a word I'd certainly apply to Sarah Smarsh, whose memoir, Heartland, wraps up this year's list. Smarsh hails from the white rural working class, and she writes about politics, race, cooking with Crisco, and class contempt with a lyrical boldness. I wish everyone this holiday season the gift of good books and plenty of time to read them.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, we'll hear some great new roots and rockabilly Christmas songs performed in our studio by their composer, J.D. McPherson, and his band. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Holly, she really makes the season jolly. Deck divinely head to toe, lovely green and scarlet bows, holding me, oh my, oh golly.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. After pledging to never make an album of Christmas songs, my guest, roots and rockabilly musician J.D. McPherson, has broken that promise, and I'm really glad he did. His new album, Socks, features his original holiday songs, and they're really fun. McPherson and his band came to our studio last week with their instruments to play some of those new Christmas songs and talk about music and other things. McPherson is a songwriter, singer, and guitarist who was described by music critic Ann Powers as a supreme rock reinventor. McPherson grew up far away from the hubs of the music world on a cattle ranch in Oklahoma. His father runs the ranch. His mother is a preacher. Before becoming a full-time musician, McPherson taught art for 4 years to students in middle school. His Christmas album, Socks, is his fourth album. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. It's so exciting to have you here, and the new Christmas album is great. JD, I'm going to ask you to introduce the first song and to introduce the members of the band.
Certainly. So my name's JD McPherson, and over to my left is everybody else. That's Doug Corcoran, the utility guy, plays everything. Jimmy Sutton on bass. Ray Hasildo plays keys, background vocals, and our friend Jason Smay on drums.
Though Jason isn't here, I should say.
That's correct. He's too loud.
We're not going to be hearing him.
He's too loud. He's in a straitjacket in the other room.
Too loud for our little studio. Okay, do you want to introduce the first song?
Yeah, this is All the Gifts I Need.
Happiness is automatic. There's music in the air. Grab the boxes from the attic and haul them down the stairs. Freezing weather's round the corner and everybody knows.
Oh, 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 oh.
Soon the tree will be all lit up, sparkling as it goes. Today's anything but the same old thing. I can almost hear those sleigh bells ring. Singing all those happy songs while the little ones alone. I take a real quick look around and suddenly I see it's not even Christmas yet. I got all the gifts I need. Got caught hanging the mistletoe. Somebody stole a little kiss. I ain't tied a single bow, but I can already cross love off my list. I take a real quick look around and suddenly I see it's not even Christmas yet. I got all the gifts I need. I take a real quick look around and suddenly I see it's not even Christmas yet. I got all the gifts I need.
Thank you so much for performing that. That is so great. And this is in our studio. We heard J.D. McPherson on vocals and guitar, Jimmy Sutton, bass and guitar, and also singing backup vocals, Doug Corcoran and Ray Hasildo. And that is one of the songs that's also featured on J.D.'s new album, which is called Socks. And it's an album of original Christmas songs. And it's really fun, just like the song we just heard. J.D., what did you want to do? Christmas album, I'm glad you did it. Why did you want to?
Well, I didn't want to for a long time. We had done a Christmas song. So I started professional, like touring, I guess you'd call it. I always had bands, but I started touring pretty, you know, in my 30s. And once I was on the road and doing it and making it happen, pretty much anything anyone told me to do, I would do it. It's like, okay, yes, please don't take this away from me. So a few years back, our label at the time said, why don't you do a Christmas song? And I said, okay. And so I did it. And it actually went okay. And it was a lot of fun. I'm actually a big Christmas fan. But, you know, we did it. And then I was like, I won't do anymore. That was it. And then there was a few things that happened that made it seem like it was okay. For one thing, Nick Lowe made a record that was like a brilliant approach to holiday music. And he kind of set this like standard of this could be actually pretty interesting. And so I have to say, once we actually did it, it's probably the most fun we've ever had
making
the record.
So there's another Christmas song I'd like you to do, and it's called Ugly Sweater Blues. Can you do that song for us?
Mm-hmm.
So this is J.D. McPherson and his band performing in our studio. We're going to hear J.D. on guitar and vocals, Jimmy Sutton on bass. Doug Corcoran is going to be playing steel guitar, and Ray Hasildo chimes. So here we go.
Mama, don't make me wear that old thing again. Hand-knitted Christmas tree in a silly snowman. No matter if I refuse, I got these ugly sweater blues. Mama, why can't you see I feel like a fool? Green elves with snowflakes and scratchy alpaca wool. Maybe you heard the news, I got these ugly sweater blues. Another year, another sweater, and another holiday soiree. Mama hears the people laughing while the presents are unwrapping. She's not even sorry. Mama, don't make me wear that old thing again. Green elves with sleigh bells and a gingerbread man. Corduroys and pointy shoes. I got these ugly sweater blues. Cardigan, oh, what a shame. Mama, don't make me wear that old thing again. Hand-knitted Christmas trees and a silly snowman. No matter if I refuse, I got these ugly sweater blues. Done paid all my dues, I'm singing these ugly sweater blues.
That sounded great. That's such a great song.
Thank you. Thank you.
That song is written by J.D. McPherson, who we heard on guitar and vocals. And this is one of the songs that he wrote that's on the new Christmas album, Socks, that he recorded with his band. And thank you for playing this in the studio for us.
This is so much fun. Thank you for having us.
This is so much fun for me. So, J.D., I want to ask you a little bit about your past, because you grew up on a cattle farm.
Yeah.
In Oklahoma. So, like, describe it for us.
160 acres or thereabouts, an A-frame house that my dad built up on a hill. Southeast Oklahoma is really pretty. I think it's the prettiest part of Oklahoma, mountainous kind of Ozark type landscape. Registered Brangus cattle, a 1940s Massey Harris tractor, and nothing else to do but to obsess over music and draw pictures.
What music were you obsessing on early on?
Well, so when my brain sort of turned on was my older brothers were teenagers in the 70s, and so their music was kind of guitar rock, classic rock, they call it nowadays. Cream, Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, etc. And I was interested in it, and I was interested in guitar, and so my older brother John Aaron would teach me a thing here and there. And the more I kind of listened to these things, I guess became curious about what they were listening to. I mean, I couldn't stop listening and reading because it was so difficult to get music. I would have to call, like the mall in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and place an order for 3 CDs that I just read about in the Cream magazine that I bought the last time I was in Fort Smith. So it was like this constant sort of mining. And, you know, you read things and you find out that, you know, Robert Plant was into Benny Joy and the Everly Brothers and Little Richard. And so, I don't know, when I kind of stumbled on that stuff, that was kind of a really big deal. I just remember asking my brother also if I started getting into kind of punk rock music and asking my brother, hey, John Aaron, you were around in the 70s. Did you ever listen to punk rock? And he said, no. So that was the twain. We split up there.
So you mentioned punk rock. Did you start in a punk rock band?
Yeah. So me and my friend Mitchell had 3 bands with the same, just the same 2 members, basically. We would my nephew eventually, we taught him how to play bass, so we had a trio. But yeah, we played 2 shows. One of them was canceled. that was John Sparks's backyard. Cowboys don't really like X and Buzzcocks and stuff like that.
Right, you had no audience.
Right.
Oh,
but
yeah.
We worked so hard on it.
Oh, gee, that
we
must
made
have been
flyers.
That must have been so discouraging. You love this music, and there's nobody to listen to it with.
Nah, not really.
To play
it was just fun. It's just a good thing to do. And your idol setting at 14, 15 years old is frustration. So you just do stuff because you're supposed to do it. And it's like you against the world, and so that's what we did.
So your mother was
my mother. Yeah,
was a preacher.
It still is. Yeah,
still is.
Mm-hmm.
What church?
The Word of Life Church in Bache, Oklahoma. It was a big deal because where we lived, that wasn't really, people didn't really like that. And some people, I guess, didn't really like that there was a woman preacher. And she's an incredible lady. She always supported my music. She kept the cops from shutting us down in McAllister when my little band played our first gig at the public amphitheater.
Why were they going to shut it down?
Because it was loud and bad.
And they don't shut things down for aesthetic reasons. They
yeah.
shut it down for others.
McAllister police, they don't have, you know, there's not a lot going on. So when kids with skateboards show up and distortion boxes and singing songs by people from England, I don't know. They wanted to shut her down. But I just remember my mom. I didn't even know she was there. But she was there, and she went over and talked to them and said, let these kids play.
So was your family church the church where your mother preached?
Yeah, yeah.
So you grew up with your mother preaching?
Yeah.
What did she preach? Like, what are some memorable things from her sermon?
Well, it was a non-denominational service. It was really heavy on music. There was a lot of music. I started off drums there. My brother played guitar.
So you played what in your mother's church?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What music did you play?
You know, it wasn't like hymns. It wasn't, they were kind of songs written by people, non-published material. It was an interesting place. Like, there was a lot of different kind of, like, I remember, you know, we would bring guys from the Jackie Brennan Correctional Facility to church and got to know a lot of those guys. Some of those guys played in the band. I don't know, now that I look back, you know, it was just church, but, you know, it was a pretty interesting place, actually.
That sounds
yeah.
it. Sing a few bars of one of the songs that you did in church.
I remember my dad used to sing this song called Cover Me that I really liked. And this is going to be, literally never. Cover me, cover me, extend the borders of thy mantle over me, for thou art my nearest kinsman. Cover me, cover me, cover me. Repeat.
That's really nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to close with another, that is, I want you to close with another Christmas song. There's a song I love from the new album, your new album, Socks, that I'd like you to perform for us. And it's called What's That Sound? And I think everyone in the band is going to chime in on that one.
Yeah. Well, this one, I think, is probably getting down to the root of that anti-cynicism sentiment we were just speaking about. This one's about all of those nice things that you can experience during that time of year.
So this is J.D. McPherson and his band performing in our studio. And the song is What's That Sound? And it's also on their new Christmas album, which is called Socks.
Okay, here we go.
What's that sound at the door I hear? I heard that same merry sound last year. Neighbors are caroling around the town, trying to spread a little bit of joy around. I hear that sound, make me feel so fine. Sounds a little bit like Christmas time. What's that sound down the road I hear? I heard that same mighty sound last year. Parade drummers marching out two by two, rocking out the holiday boogaloo. What's that sound? It sounds like Christmas time. If you listen closely now, you'll hear it in the air. That's the sound of Christmas cheer. I hear it everywhere. What's that sound at the mall I hear? I heard that same busy sound last year. Shoppers are hopping and a humming a tune. A happy holidays and how do you do? What's that sound? It sounds like Christmas time. If you listen closely now, you hear it in the air. That's the sound of Christmas cheer. I hear it everywhere. What's that sound on the roof I hear? I heard that same pitter-pat last year. Jingling bells in big black boots, a rattling chimney and 32 hoods. I hear that sound, make me feel so fine. Sounds a little bit like Christmas time. What's that sound down the road I hear? I heard that same ringing bell last year. Ringing that thing like he's leading a band, trying to give a neighbor a helping hand. What's that sound? It sounds like Christmas time. What's that sound? It sounds like Christmas time. What's that sound? It sounds like Christmas time.
Ding, ding, ding. Well, that was great. Thank you so much for performing for us in our studio. It's just been wonderful. I wish you all Merry Christmas, a really happy and healthy 2019, and great musical things, too. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
Our thanks to J.D. McPherson and his band. Their new Christmas album is called Socks. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.